and Bristol A Voice.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, the parents of murdered schoolgirl Millie Dowler say their experience during the trial of their daughter's killer was cruel and inhumane. Millie's sister, Gemma, says the way they were cross-examined was the worst day of her life. Convicted killer Levi Belfield has been given a life sentence for the abduction and murder of Millie. Millie's parents were also critical of the initial police investigation, during which chances were missed to catch Belfield, who went on to murder two more victims. Detective Chief Inspector Maria Woodall says they've apologised to the family and they've learnt from their mistakes.
The lengths we went to in this investigation to follow up numerous promising leads were extensive, and we had to consider all possibilities. Some lines of inquiry subsequently proved to be more significant than others, but we could have not known this at the time.
A man who was fatally stabbed during an alleged break-in in Salford was already on bail for burglary. Detectives have been given an extra 36 hours to question a man over John Burnell's death. There's been a significant rise in the number of cases of measles in England and Wales. The Health Protection Agency says more people contracted the virus in the first 5 months of this year compared with the whole of 2010. Andy Murray is due on court later for his third-round match at Wimbledon. Simon Owen is on centre court.
Yes, and Murray with a bit of a wait still, because the match before is taking a while. He's up against Ivan Ljubicic in round three, the 32-year-old Croatia making his centre court debut today. Murray, the only British player left standing now after defeats earlier for Laura Robson and Elena Bartacha. Robson threatening a huge upset against Maria Sharapova, but she couldn't quite pull it off.
There are worries about hundreds of jobs at Habitat after the UK arm of the chain went to administration. Home Retail Group, which owns Argos and Homebase, has bought all but 30 stores, meaning the future of over 700 staff is uncertain. More supermarkets are cutting the price of fuel after Tesco announced it was slashing 3p from the cost of a litre of petrol and diesel from today. Sainsbury's and Asda are introducing the same reduction from tomorrow. That's the latest.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello Bristol and welcome to the BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review the news this week is Green Councillor for Ashley, that's Gus Hoyt. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, many complaints have gone into Avon and Somerset Police about the way 160 riot cops over Easter were used to arrest one person suspected of building a petrol bomb, plus the disturbances that followed. For many, though, going through the police complaints process is not enough, and the police investigating themselves can sometimes seem to be an unsatisfactory way to get justice. Also, while Lib Dem MP Stephen Williams has come out in favour of a new Conservative bill to make squatting a criminal offence, and we talked to one local resident injured in the riot, who does not blame the squatters for the disturbances. That's Simon Lewis. Plus, our third extract from Keith Allen's banned film Unlawful Killing about the assassination of Princess Diana, which is being watched everywhere around the world except Britain. And San Francisco's skyscraper architect Richard Gage gave a talk at the Colston Hall on Tuesday evening this week. I spoke to him about the key evidence that proves controlled demolition and what this means for America. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius, getting pretty cool and fairly wet with some gusty winds. This weekend, highs 23 Celsius. Some showers on Saturday, but warming up for a sunny day on Sunday. I'm sure those at Glastonbury waterlogged overnight on Saturday will be very pleased to hear that. And next week, highs of 23 Celsius, cooling down a bit after Monday, but still fairly sunny with some showers midweek. So sounds like Sunday and Monday are going to be lovely weather. Next weekend, that's the 2nd and 3rd of July, highs of 16 Celsius, sunny spells and probably dry. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests. And joining us is Green Councillor for Ashley, that is Gus Hoyt. Hi, Gus, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi there, Tony. Good to be here.
Now, first of all, you're a Green Councillor. You've just got elected. But why the Green Party? Why not one of the others?
To be honest, I think it's come to a time now where everyone is fully disillusioned with the big three, really, and everyone's actually looking for alternative answers.
And why not? You mean you could have joined Respect? You could have even joined the BNP. Why not? Why not the Green Party? Why the Green Party, and why not the others?
Respect. I'll give you some respect over the BNP. I could take was just a jibe. Obviously, I think the Green Party has basically the answers to the age-old problems which are facing us at the moment, and people do tend to realise that.
Which answers do you thinking of particularly?
But basically, just looking at. Having small, really, truly sustainable communities, and that does mean introducing elements of socialism back into the workplace, and that does mean looking at things with an environmental perspective.
Now, here we hear about sustainable communities, we tend to think of things like villages and smaller people, but how do we do that in a city?
Well, that's a very good question. Basically, you've got to kind of think of it on a village kind of scale. But also, of course, you know, we do live in a city, and some things you can't do for yourself. I remember going to the Zero Carbon Bristol event about a year and a half ago, and the only person that actually put up their hand to say that we couldn't actually have a fully sustainable city on itself was the person that wrote the sustainable or the carbon-free Britain report. Out of Cat in Macunthalith, the Centre of Alternative Technology, he realised that, of course, we do all depend on other communities to really survive.
All right. Now, how have you found life as a councillor? Because you're only the second councillor that the Green Party have had in the city. So how's it been, your first month or so?
Well, first month and a bit has been incredibly busy. I've had to give up my full-time job just because we're being contacted not just by people in the ward, but people concerned with lots of other issues outside of the ward, not just green issues, but a lot of sort of equality issues. Obviously, ESOL's a big deal at the moment. There's a huge controversy over Hooters in the city centre.
ESOL? What's that?
That's English for speakers of another language. All these courses are being cut at the moment, which really affects en masse greatly affects the female Somali people within our communities.
Because I know this is one of the things that teachers are constantly saying, is that it's really difficult for them to be teaching classes when it's not just that English is a second language for some people. For some people, it's very, very difficult for them to even be communicating in class. So this is a service which brings people up to speed with English so the teachers can just get on and do their job.
Yeah, I mean, you know, David Cameron at the moment is obviously talking about, you know, the big society and us all chipping in together, and that everyone should learn to speak English. And at the same time, seems to be driven to actually divide society by building walls, which means we can't even communicate with each other.
What was your full-time job that you had to give up then to the other day or recently to really do your job properly as a councillor?
I've been renovating houses. Okay. just been employed as a builder, basically.
All right, Gus, well, let's introduce Martin now, Martin Summers. Martin, what I'm going to ask you this week is about something I was watching on the Kaiser report this week on Russia Today. It seems apparently one of the best ways to get out of a recession in the situation that we are now, he had an economist on there and he was agreeing with him, was saying, actually, it doesn't sound like the obvious thing to do, but if we increase wages now, this will bring us out of a recession. Is that true?
Absolutely. The idea that you can downsize wages in order to get end a recession is false. What you need to do is support demand for ordinary people, and you need to build infrastructure, and you need to put money in people's pockets. And the only way to do that, of course, is a bit of redistribution. You can't just do it with deficit financing. But the fantasy the capitalist class seems to have is that they will be able to force British wages down to Chinese levels, and then somehow the economy will spontaneously regenerate. It's absolutely barking mad, and 50 years ago we learned not to do it like this, but I'm afraid there's a very retro streak in the current government.
Yeah, the thing that was kind of slightly annoying me watching this thing on the TV was hang on a minute, businesses just can't afford to up the wages that because a lot of them are having trouble even paying the wages as they are at the moment, so this isn't a realistic idea, is
it? It is. What you do is you increase overall demand in the economy so that the businesses are actually making a profit and can afford to pay higher wages. I mean, Henry Ford years ago realise that everybody who works on his production line must have the possibility to buy what they're producing. Now, that was just within one firm, but we think of it as the whole economy. Somebody's wages are somebody else's customers. Yeah, that's the money they've got will be spent in the economy.
Well, I can see why it's going to be good effect of it, but I can't see where, for example, small business owners, medium-sized business owners are going to get this extra money to pay extra wages to their staff.
You've got to reflate the economy, which means first of all you've got to start spending money on the government's got to start spending money on things which we need, like English as second language classes, for example. And you write a list of things you want. I've got a big thing that I've wanted to see for years, which is state-of-the-art nursery education for all our kids, like they have in Scandinavia. It makes a huge difference to the social, to the society. But we've never got round to it. Sure Start is just, you know, fiddling at the edges, really. And when you write a list of things you want, you spend the money on it. Those things, that money flows into the economy, and it goes to your people to spend on what they want. And then, of course, the small businesses, as they rise on the tide, and they've got the money to pay higher wages. Incidentally, in Scandinavia, businesses which can't pay high wages are deliberately bankrupted, because we don't want a low-wage economy. In Britain, we've had this idea, we've got to keep wages down, and then we just get rid of all that junk and get something more sensible to do. In Norway, they're increasing the numbers of people employed in manufacturing industry, even as we speak, in the middle of a global recession. And that's because they know how to manage their stuff. They don't have lots of crummy small businessmen saying, I can't afford to pay high wages. They just bankrupt them and reuse the resources that were locked up in those businesses to do something more sensible. We've lost this. We never really had the skill in the way the Norwegians have got it. They've got a sovereign wealth fund which is the biggest in the world. They've got a state oil industry which is the best managed in the world. They've got money coming out of their ears for nursery schools for their kids.
It sounds nice, but doesn't Britain have a sovereign wealth fund? Don't we?
No, because we've got no wealth. What we did is
this country's one of the most wealthy in the world.
We are wealthy, but it's all in the hands of the wealthy. It's not in the hands of the government. The sovereign wealth fund belongs to the Norwegian people. It doesn't belong to individuals. And, these things were known about and have been known about for a long time. But we've got vested interests in this country, like the City of London, which is actually a net drain on our economy. That's quite clear after all of these bailouts, that all the money they claim they bring into the economy has gone out of the economy again to bail them out.
So are you saying that people like HSBC, who are holding a gun to the head of the government, saying, we are threatening to leave, we're going to go and base ourselves in Hong Kong, you're saying they should go?
Yeah, because if they go to Hong Kong, they can bankrupt the Hong Kong economy instead of ours. I mean, Iceland, for example, didn't have private banks until 2004. They then drank the Kool-Aid and had some private banks, and then everything went down the tubes. I mean, they had their own perfectly managed state-run banks. What else do you need?
Okay, Green Councillor for Ashley, Gus. Does the Green Party have an economics policy?
Yes, of course we do. And I would like to add as well that on top of those points, some people have come away from the recession in an incredibly good way.
Absolutely.
And that's the billionaires. We've seen a huge rise in billionaires since the beginning of the credit crunch, if you must call it that, but repression, depression, whatever it really is. Money is being distributed in completely, completely the wrong way. And I'd agree that, yes, we do need an increased, not even minimum wage, but what we call it is the livable wage.
What is the Green Party's actual policy then? A livable wage? But that's easy to say, but what does that actually mean? And what's, for example, is the Green Party's policy for dealing with unemployment, mass unemployment, as we have now? And we're talking about the Lib Cons possibly putting another 500,000 public employees onto the dole.
Yep, and I don't think that's a possibly. I think they're definitely aiming to make these people unemployed. I think that was one of their objectives from the start. As far as unemployment goes, the Green Party has a very clear documents on this subject, and it concerns the citizens' income. It redistributes the ideas of pensions, of benefits, of housing benefits, disability benefits. Everyone, and it doesn't matter whether you're paid or not, whether you're in work or not, you can claim your citizen's allowance. So it gets rid of any kind of stigma and difficulty and any blockage. There's no need to go down and fill out your forms in triplicate and keep coming back week after week and just demanding to be treated like a basic human being.
Martin, what about this citizens' income? Yep. Is that something that Absolutely. You sort of, as an old Labour
to be honest with you, my views on economics are probably closer to those of the Green Party than to our own front bench. Why I stay in the Labour Party is because I see it as the main chance to stop the insanity coming from the top. And I welcome Gus's election in Ashley, even though it's a shame for Thangam, who is also a very good candidate.
Yeah, but what about my question about the citizens' income? Is this something which will
work? It's a good
idea,
yes, absolutely. We need to start thinking radically now. It's all hands on deck. The banks are possibly... This Greek default could bring down the entire banking system. I took a bet on that with a guy last night. I bet him a fiver that the banks wouldn't be there in by Christmas. And he works in a bank. He works for Lloyds. And he took the bet. And I said to him, I hope I don't win this bet. And he said, I hope you don't too. But we are in that kind of situation. And the time to come forward with radical ideas is now. Citizens' income, universal nursery education, withdrawal from Afghanistan. It's crash, bang, wallop. We've got to start getting up to speed, because this is a very, very dangerous situation.
But all of this is going to cost money, Martin. We're constantly
yes,
told
and
there
the
is...
money, the money is in the hands of the billionaires, as he's just pointed out. This whole thing is based on what the Austrian School of Economists call malinvestment. There are no real profits, they're just paper profits. It's Enron-style accounting. That money isn't their money, it is our money, and we want it back. Now, what I suggest we do with the wealthy classes is we assemble a series of instruments of torture for them. Thumbscrews, racks, you know, the property taxes here, you know, a series of mechanisms for getting the money off them. And we will just show them the instruments to freak them out, and then we will start saying, now, are you going to start cooperating and give us the money, or are we going to start using this stuff on you? Because we've got to start talking hardball with these people.
Well, like,
we're going to be talking later about the 9/11 and the Twin Towers. This is a very bad situation. The wealthy classes are completely out of order. They must be disciplined. Aristotle understood this. The main threat to democracy comes from oligarchy. And that's where we are. And we're going to go back to democracy, and oligarchy's got to go.
But aren't the rich people simply just going to jet off to the Bahamas, Martin, before you can catch them?
It's funny you should mention the Bahamas, because all of these so-called tax havens are, in fact, British dependencies, and we could invade them all, couldn't we?
Well, it might be the Channel Islands, as Stephen Lansdowne.
Yes, I remember seeing Mark Thomas doing a debate on Radio 4 why we should invade the Channel Islands. Never mind the Falklands, never mind Iraq, let's invade the Channel Islands and make them pay their taxes.
Yes, and on a quite serious point, Kerry McCarthy popped up at Prime Minister's Questions this week, that's the Bristol East Labour MP, to ask David Cameron on Wednesday all about the division in society that she thinks has got, I mean, it got worse under Labour, but it's continuing to get worse. That's the division between rich and poor. So let's have a listen to what she had to say on Wednesday in the House of Commons.
Kerry McCarthy.
Thank you. I thank the Prime Minister for that response, and can I associate myself and my constituents with the moving tributes that he's just paid. A year ago today, the Chancellor stood up in the House to deliver his first budget. Yeah. Given that on the government's own assessment, the efforts will have a statistically insignificant impact on child poverty, can I recommend that the Prime Minister watches the BBC documentary Poor Kids to find out how the other half lives? And can I ask him if he regrets allowing his Chancellor to take money away from families with children rather from the bankers who caused the financial crisis in the first place?
I will certainly look at the programme the Honourable Lady mentions, but what I would say is, even at a difficult time, this government put more money into child tax credits for the poorest families, we've frozen the council tax, and we've actually taken steps to help working families, and the budget and the subsequent budget, neither of them actually raised child poverty because of the steps that we took. We inherited a complete mess from the party opposite, but we're dealing with it in a way that protects families. Angie
Bray. Martin, that's Kerry McCarthy and David Cameron there in exchange at Prime Minister's Question Time. Essentially what he's saying there is that actually they haven't made it any worse, that the big gap between rich and poor opened up under Labour.
Indeed, and also under the fact that we've had a Thatcher New Labour era, and we're now carrying on steroids on the same miserable path. Basically, there's not been a serious debate about economic policy in this country for a generation. That's the problem. What happened in 1979 is basically a rather crackpot free market theory became central to everybody's thinking. The sort of stuff that's been coming, that the people have been coming out with, rational expectations theory, as it's called, the idea that the market will always distribute wealth efficiently and so on, this was discredited 50 years ago and shown to be wrong. It's not just that it's a difference of opinion on the economy. There isn't a difference of opinion about it. Basically, that was the previous way of looking at it was right. The free, super free market way of looking at it was wrong. And that's why we've had a massive economic crisis, because the people in charge, frankly, don't know what they're doing. And that includes David Cameron. But can I just compliment Kerry there on getting a feisty jab in, because she was supposed to be talking about something else, wasn't she? And she caught him by surprise. Good. Solar plexus. Oh.
Gus Hoyt, Green Councillor for Ashley, what would the Green Party do about this? Because you must be from time to time coming across this within your ward, big divisions between rich and poor, and people who are, for example, cut off benefits, have no income, and all of a sudden they can't focus on either getting a job if they haven't got one, or continuing with their job if they have. Everything then suddenly becomes all hands on deck, and it's an emergency. So what would the Greens do about this? I mean, if you had a little bit more power in Westminster, now having your first MP, don't you? You've got an MP now.
That's
after
correct,
the last general election.
Yeah, thanks, Danny. realistically, I don't want to start getting anyone's hopes up by saying we will do this, we will do that, because obviously we do only have one MP at the moment in Parliament. Part of our manifesto nationally was for the Green New Deal. Now, this is nothing like what we've been given at the moment, which is being dressed up as a Green New Deal, and that's the yellow and blue Green Deal which we're getting. The actual real Green Deal would have invested not just in training, well, it would have invested in training, it would have provided government paid jobs, and it would have tackled climate change, doing everything from simple roof insulation courses to PV, which is photovoltaic, that's creating electricity from people's rooftops, and also heating people's homes through hot water, and many other schemes aside. Basically, a bit like, you know, the original New Deal, really.
So how does that really help with this whole balance of rich and poor? Because that's really what we're talking about, mm-hmm. What Kerry's talking about there. And before you answer that, let's have a listen to an extract from the programme she's talking about, Poor Kids, which was shown about 10 days, 2 weeks ago on BBC Two.
Between rich and poor in the UK is now wider than at any time since the Second World War.
It doesn't get any better. It gets worse and worse as the days go on.
We asked four children to show us what life is really like growing up in Britain today below the poverty line.
There's all sorts of things that happen bad around here in my life.
Money is the main priority. I always worry about it.
All of the children in this film have their parents' permission to talk to us. They live at home and they speak for the 3.5 million or so kids who are living in poverty in Britain today. This is their story.
My name's Sam. I'm 11 years old and I live in Leicester.
I think I'm poor because I get 420 quid a month. Now goes on what we need and not what we want. We have to spend it on food and electric and gas. The electric is put on a key which goes into a box and Dad puts a fiver on it every so often. And when we run out of electric, the whole house goes. Everything just shuts off. Except for battery powered stuff and candles. And the gas, when that runs out, the whole house is freezing. You see me running upstairs, getting my cami, which is on my bed. I'm sitting here going like...
Well, hopefully you won't be doing that this weekend because it'll be nice and warm. But some pretty shocking stuff in that series, Martin. I'm not sure whether you watched it or not.
No,
I'm
afraid
you?
I didn't.
But it seems like we've got a whole load of people now living in poverty in this country who are really actually cannot simply pay the bills. That is to say, electricity, gas, water, rent, all these basic things, it's now becoming impossible to pay.
It is, but in actual fact, we've always had poverty in this country. For example, our old people die in the winter because they can't heat their houses. It's a scandal that's been going on for generations and nothing's been done about it. You go to Norway, of course, where it's much colder than in Britain, and it just doesn't happen. Because their old people have enough money and resources to heat their houses. And they live in nice houses, which have been provided for them by the nice country they live in. And we look across, you just have to look across the North Sea to see what's wrong with Britain. And, of course, there is a Norwegian streak in the British character. I believe Skargil is a Norwegian name.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, realistically, we just have to tackle every aspect of society. This is not just, you can't just earmark some money, some extra money for the kids. Realistically, it's going to be done, as we've spoken already, by just cutting the earnings of the richest. No one in any company should earn more than 10 times the lowest paid person in that company. And there should be a super tax for anyone, you know, earning ridiculous amounts of money that we see in a society, because basically when someone is earning millions or billions of pounds a year, they're stealing from the pockets of their workers or from the unemployed.
In Norway, everybody's tax returns are public property.
Yeah.
That encourages people to think, hang on a minute, how much do they earn? Because people don't realise how super wealthy the super wealthy really are. They think they're wealthy, they don't realise how wealthy they are. And of course, our celebrity culture encourages people to think that they're all going to become footballers and footballers' wives. Of course, they're not. they're going to live like this poor little lad we just heard on, yeah, on the radio.
The culture of the individual, really, as well, yes, of competition and one person against each other rather than actually work together, right, as a neighbourhood or a community.
Social solidarity out the window.
The thing that bothers me with these 3 million or so children living in poverty in Britain is it's becoming almost like the survival of the fittest.
Well, I'll tell you what's going to happen. My sister is teaching kids who've been removed from ordinary schools because they're dysfunctional and they can't function in ordinary schools. The unit where she works is about to be closed down. They think, they don't know, it's all to do with the cuts. The teachers are facing P45s. The kids are rebelling because they don't know what the hell's going on. And when he sounded like a very nice little lad, the one we heard there. He's 11 years old. But of course, dysfunctional people living in desperate circumstances become dysfunctional, and we look around and we see all of this shocking teenage violence on other teenagers, death, stalking the streets. 30,000 people have died in North Mexico, for example, in drug-related violence in the last 3 years alone. That is the future. Think of the United States of America, with crashed into the bottom of a depression, with no unemployment benefits and everybody with automatic weapons. Just think of all that. And then wonder why. What we really need to tell the wealthy classes, it's time to understand what the deal is. We provide the blood, you provide the money. Yeah, it's that everybody knew after World War One and World War Two what the deal was. These people are basically taking the puh.
Gus, you're a councillor for Ashley Ward. Do you think that actually there's a situation here where sometimes people are in poverty, they're trying to get jobs, they're feeling that there's difficult for them to get a future, and so they get into organised crime? Is that actually an alternative? Because I know there's actually quite a lot of drug dealing and stuff goes on in that part of the city. So that seems to me as if actually
in all parts of the city. So
it probably does. Yeah. Maybe in Clifton too.
Don't kid yourself.
They just charge more elsewhere.
But is this a real problem, do you think, in where you are and in other parts of the city?
Well, if you're talking about the issue of drug use, I mean, basically a lot of the problems.
Well, dealing. What I'm thinking is actually, if you can't get an income, well, there's someone down the street corner that might be able to provide you with one.
Yeah, and of course, if it was just decriminalised, that person that was dealing with would then not be a criminal and have to use violence as a tool of repression as well.
Well, you're reminding me of that old B movie Key Largo, where there's a guy in it. This is from the 50s, I think, where the mafia turn up in town, and actually the thing that they're some mafia character, his biggest fear is legalization of or prohibition.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, because he's actually making a fortune out of prohibition, and the idea that it might end is actually his biggest fear.
Yeah, I think the largest blockade really to any kind of legalization of soft or hard drugs would be the main criminals involved, who internationally are making the most money.
And the main criminals are, of course, the US intelligence services, the CIA, who brought up millions of dollars of cocaine into the United States in the 1980s to fund their Contra war in Nicaragua. They're another vested interest.
The Iran-Contra thing, I think, is also, it's one of those places where, amazingly, for a couple of years, it was exposed publicly that these senior military intelligence people had been, actually, their main job wasn't anything to do with military intelligence, it was drug dealing for political purposes. Can you just explain what the Iran-Contra scandal was?
Well, it came out, we call it the Iran-Contra scandal because that's the name that the media in the US decided to call it. But it was Senator Kerry's committee that investigated all of this. Basically, Ronald Reagan wanted to make war against the democratically elected government of Nicaragua. But the Congress, which was controlled by the Democrats at the time, said, no, you can't. We're perfectly happy for them to have their government. We're not going to fight against them. So Reagan then got on to Colonel Oliver North and others, Poindexter, in fact, many of them, Bush administration, they've turned up in the Bush administration later, and they just set up a whole parallel legal structure where Adolfo Calero from the FLN, which was the opposition in Nicaragua, brought all the massive amounts of cocaine into the US through Mena Air Base in Arkansas with a wink from Bill Clinton, and he got a cut of the money. And then the money was used to fund the terrorist campaign which killed 30,000 civilians in Nicaragua. I mean, this is all on the record. This isn't conspiracy theory, it's history. Look it up on Wikipedia.
I know.
And it just drives me bonkers when people say, oh, this is just a conspiracy theory. It's not. It's historical fact.
Well, because Oliver North was going to go down for it, wasn't he?
Yes, well, what they do is that when George Bush Sr. Left office, it's that they have a very bizarre system in America where the president can pardon up to 200 criminals, like a king deciding mercifully to pardon 200 criminals. And of course, he doesn't pardon Jesus, he pardons Barabbas. Yeah, that's what happens. And it's just an absurd system. Basically, the United States has been run by criminals, and it's been run by criminals for many years. And I'm afraid it's about time the British people woke up and saw who their allies actually are, because they are going to lead us into a world war if we don't pull our finger out and tell them to stop.
Okay, final word to you on this, Gus. Poor kids, what are we going to do to help them?
Well, in the short-term future or longer term? I mean, in the short-term future, all we can do, realistically, is just, well, just help out as much as you can. There's plenty of organisations in every part of the city, because poverty is everywhere. It's not just in Ashley, though of course it's very prevalent there.
I was hearing just yesterday on Andrew's Dry Time show about the food bank, Bristol Food Bank, for example. So there are ways, if for whatever reason people get cut off from a benefit, they find themselves in debt where the benefits aren't actually able to do what you need to do because of the debt burden. So yes, there are services out there. Of course, the other thing is, what rather irks me is when the Social Security people get in a contractor or whatever who's actually paid a bonus to kick people off of benefits. That I find really irksome. Anyway, that's just my little peccadillo there. On to our next story, and 10 out of 12 care homes in Bristol could be shut. This is another one. Really connected, all this is unbelievably connected up to this economics stuff, isn't it? Because, Gary Hopkins has had his parks, unpopular parks, buses disaster, and the blue taxis. It now seems that John Rogers is taking over. Is John Rogers the new Gary Hopkins? Anyway.
You're going to get me in trouble on this one, aren't you?
It is unveiled that 10 of Bristol's 12 council-run old people's homes and a number of daycare centres could be shut under new proposals. The authority says the closures could release £20 million to give elderly and vulnerable people more independence. Well, it means, I suppose, sending people in to look after them from time to time at home instead of actually caring for them in a care home. It unveiled its ideas at a public meeting in Knowle yesterday and will consult more widely before making a final decision in September. But the plans have already provoked concern among campaigners, unions and opposition councillors. They said older people were easy targets and should not be uprooted. Together, the closure-threatened homes care for an estimated 500 residents. Councillor Jenny Smith, Labour's spokeswoman on care, was also concerned about the quality of the possible alternative private providers. She said the council would have to reassure residents that their elderly relatives would be properly protected. While we all agree that older people's lives are enriched by being supported to stay in their own home as long as possible, this blunt announcement will cause widespread anxiety among existing daycare users. And others. Now, this also comes at the same time as another story, which is really concerning, which is also the headline is Bristol Council payout ordered over poor care. And this is about someone who was being cared for. Mrs. Shipway was found on a soiled bed, bleeding from scratches on her legs. Bristol City Council has been ordered to pay compensation to an elderly woman who was left in a soiled bed sheets at a care home. Gus, do you want to talk first about this? 10 out of 12 care homes in the city proposed to be closed, 500 residents then having to find somewhere else to live.
Yeah, well, the first thing I can say is I'm glad that they're not just railroading this one through, that they are actually going out to consultation, and I'm sure they're going to hear what the community thinks in a very, very loud voice. I certainly hope so.
Because my problem here is that for those 500 people, they're now going to be really worried, and the families of them, are they going to be able to stay where they are at the moment?
And the excuse that we're given, that Bristol invest the most of any city in the country, well, that's great for Bristol, but it's obviously not enough. We obviously need to be investing a lot more here in Bristol and throughout the rest of our cities. We don't live in the Arctic Circle. We don't just take our old people outside to die when they reach a certain age.
What are they doing, the artists? Okay. I used to do it years ago.
Sorry, that's one hell of a stereotype there, wasn't it? So I'll just use that to illustrate there, Martin. But basically, you know, obviously we need far more investment, not just in this form of care, but in our health service altogether.
Consultation or not, 500 people and their families now, are we really worried about what's going to be happening with their loved ones? Martin?
Well, obviously, I agree with Gus, and I hope that the community's voice is heard loud and clear. I mean, I think this has bearing on the Southern Cross crisis, where there used to be very well-run local authority homes. In fact, during the election campaign, I went round the one in... where is it now? In Barton Hill. And it was extremely nice in there, very well-run. It was clear that the people were happy, even though they were pretty far gone in terms of what they were capable of doing. But the Southern Cross crisis... where we've privatised all of this and allowed profits to be taken from it, goodness knows why we're allowing profits to be taken from this. It doesn't seem the sort of thing that ought to be made a profit on at all. And then, of course, when they get into trouble, what happens? Oh, the taxpayer has to come in and bail them out, which is probably what we'll have to do, if we can, if we've got the resources. But, I mean, this just... And at the same time, Lansley's bringing forward this, this so-called reform of the health service to bring in more of this nonsense. It's about, hasn't it? I mean, you feel like screaming with despair. The evidence that this doesn't work and actually costs more and provides a worse service is overwhelming. It's been there for years. It's a bit like Iran-Contra earlier. It's like it's all in plain sight. But nevertheless, they carry on with the same ideologically blinkered nonsense that we've been hearing for the last 30 years. And they're not, you know, basically, it's just not going to work. It's going to cost more, and loads of people are going to suffer. But let's hope they suffer politically for being so stupid.
Okay, on to our next story. And the police force, that is Avon and Somerset, are to get an elected commissioner within a year. This was in last Saturday's Evening Post. A police commissioner for Avon and Somerset with a £122,000 a year salary is set to be elected next year. Liberal Democrats have dropped their opposition to the controversial move, paving the way for elections next May. Avon and Somerset Police Authority said it was very disappointed at the news, warned of the politicisation of the police, and attacked the cost of holding the election as the force faces a £40 million worth of cuts. Avon and Somerset Police Authority's Deputy Chairwoman Claire Gordon said, "I'm very disappointed that Nick Clegg has thrown in the towel on a piece of legislation that is poorly thought out." Ms Gordon said she was very concerned about power being concentrated in one person for a diverse area covering Bristol, Bath and rural Exmoor. And also earlier this week I spoke to another member of the Avon and Somerset Police Authority, Doug Naismith, to find out what he thought about these proposals.
My name's Doug Naismith. I'm a councillor for Avonmouth, Labour councillor for Avonmouth, and I'm a member of the Police Authority, the local Avon and Somerset Police Authority. And the thing that's troubling us a bit is the proposal by the government to introduce a directly elected police commissioner, and that's got a number of drawbacks for this area. The first one being that Avon and Somerset, as people who are listening to this will realise, is a very mixed sort of population. You've got the rural areas of Somerset and county towns like Taunton, and you've got Bristol, and you've got Bath, and then you've got South Gloucestershire, and that's an extremely mixed area. How are you going to find one person who's going to represent all these different things in the way that the current police authority does? We're quite worrying.
Actually, they're talking about abolishing you, aren't they?
Yes, we are up for execution in about 9 months' time. I think next May, I think, will be our last meeting as a police authority.
Well, that's not very democratic, is it? So why is this actually happening? What's the point behind it?
Well, the current government thinks that police authorities are not very visible and that people don't know they exist. And there is an element of truth to that. Police authorities are not very high-profile bodies, but they actually get the job done. For instance, in this part of the world, police have become much more popular and much more visible over the last few years. It's partly due to having PCSOs, these officers that you see, not full policemen, but they're trained in a similar sort of way, and they're active in communities, and that's been one of the great innovations, and it's made people think that the police are doing a good job, and it just doesn't seem the right time to introduce this. Some of it comes because the current government is very influenced by what's going on in America. And there are one or two examples of really nasty spots in the States which have been cleaned up, they say, following the election of a police commissioner. But the situation is very, very different in America. And I'm not sure it's going to translate to this country as easily as some people seem to think.
That was me earlier on this week talking to Doug Naismith, Labour Councillor of Avonmouth, and he's also someone who sits on the Avon and Somerset Police Authority. Now, Gus, one of the arguments here is that the police authority is very invisible. People don't even know it exists, even though it meets publicly and the public can go along. It's very rare for any of the members of the public to actually turn up at the police authority meetings.
Yeah, that's true, and I think Doug actually covered most of the points there, really. Yes, it isn't very transparent at all, really. Unfortunately, a lot of people people don't realise where decisions are being made, not just within the police authority, but within so-called democracy within Britain itself. For example, everyone turns up to full council, where every single councillor has to show up, and yet we have no decision-making bodies there. We do need to get out and explain to people exactly where decisions are made and where appeals can be made.
Well, I'm totally opposed to this idea of a police commissioner. It seems absolutely bonkers to me. Who are we going to get? Judge Dredd, you know, take him away. And what they're looking for is that if some hard-line people will get these jobs, and then they will make a career in right-wing politics, and the tabloids will love them. But I think this is all wrong. We need to make the police more responsive and accountable. They're going about localism, and this is a centralising measure. Surely we need more local accountability for the police. And people do want to talk about things. I mean, you were at the meeting I was at the other week with the community and the police after the disturbances in Stokes Croft. That's where the people want to meet the police, is on their beat where they live. And this stuff is just gimmicks. And of course, as you've pointed out, it's going to cost a fortune. I mean, how are you going to have an election in Avon and Somerset, all of these varied areas, and who will be the candidates? Will there be a Labour police commissioner versus a Tory police commissioner? Or will we just get a celeb in, like, I don't know, let's think of a celeb.
Gordon Ramsay.
Yeah. I mean, it's just barking, in my view. It's trying to depoliticise things, and I'm sure the present system can be improved. I don't know enough about it to say. But this sort of stuff is just gimmicks. And that's all they've got, this government, is gimmicks. They haven't got an economic policy.
Well, it doesn't seem like the local Lib Dems are at all in favour of it as well, the ruling group on the council, because back in May this year, Barbara Jank came out very much against it, saying that the legislation is fundamentally flawed. How can it be right for local policing policy to be based on the results of a kind of X-factor contest?
That's right.
And on the number of votes one particular area can deliver. It's contrary to the principles of safety and security. So it sounds like one of those policies which is being parachuted in by a sort of slightly crumbly Nick Clegg from Number 10.
Yeah, I'd like to say I'm glad that locally the Lib Dems are keeping some of their policies. It's a shame that they've just dropped them completely at a national level. Everyone was saying that yellow plus blue would be green. It looks like yellow plus blue equals blue at the national level. I've actually lived in the States as well for about 4 years, and I've seen what happens when you have elected police officials and elected judges, and all that happens is that people are labelled criminal at a far earlier stage. You get the three strike and you're outlaw.
Unless you're Oliver North, of course.
Well, yes, of course. And it does. And normally it helps getting those three strikes if you do come from an ethnic minority, because that's what the police tend to target over there. But all it does is it leads to increase in sentences, increase in people in prison. They have almost 10% of their population in prison. And this is seen as a good thing, and people cheer it on the streets because it's a democratically elected police force. It's insane.
Well, nobody in this part of the world, I don't know if anybody east of Reading maybe is into this idea, and maybe the chief constable himself, but not a lot of other people. Maybe an alternative might be just simply to bring the police authority meetings into the city and have them here in Bristol rather than up in the sort of Dark Lord's Tower on Portishead, up on the hills up there. Anyway, next, not moving off policing completely, it's a pose. This is on Bristol Indie Media, and it's opposed the EDL demo in Bristol. This is a post on the Bristol Indie Media website. We're calling on the large anarchist and anti-fascist community of Bristol and elsewhere to come out and oppose the racist morons of the EDL. They're planning a demonstration to protest against a proposed mosque at Barton Hill. The location hasn't been confirmed yet, but the demo is planned for the 23rd of July. Gus, first on this, what are your thoughts about EDL? And surely they do have a right to protest against the mosque if they don't agree with it.
Well, I can't remember what political philosopher said this back in the day. I think it was sometime in the American Revolution, but he said, I'll fight for your right to say what it is you wish to say, but I will also fight you on the battlefield for what you say. I think this shouldn't just be a call to the anarchists and the anti-fascists. This should be a call to every sensible person in Bristol and surrounds. We cannot tolerate this kind of hatred that this develops. It's disgraceful in this kind of situation.
But what I'm saying is, surely everybody has a right to pray.
Not when it creates violence, no.
But I mean, you know, surely the police's job in this situation is to draw the line between counter demonstrations and to keep the peace between them.
If you've ever been to a demonstration where you're up against the EDL, logic does not come into it. That it just turns everyone into pack animals. It's that they should not be allowed to demo anywhere.
Martin?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's like the loyalist marching season in Northern Ireland. You're allowed to march, but not down their street. Just as they're not allowed to march down your street. How would they like it if the Somali nationalists came and marched down their street and said, we're going to impose Sharia law on you? That's our freedom of speech, isn't it? Of course it isn't. You're entitled to a certain amount of freedom of speech. If they turn up in Bristol, I hope our people will behave responsibly, but I want to see 200 of them and 20,000 of us, and we're working towards that goal.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what about the principle? This is a basic principle of a right to have a demonstration, a peaceful demonstration.
Yes, but you're not allowed to have a demonstration necessarily in somebody else's turf. Yeah, that's what has been agreed in the whole business in Northern Ireland, and we're seeing it. Of course, we're maybe coming on to that in a minute, the situation over there. The Gavachi Road standoffs for years, but simply because the loyalists were basically saying, every bit of this country belongs to us and you're not welcome. That's what they're saying. Now, you can have I like watching loyalist demonstrations as long as they're peaceful. And, you know, I like the loyalist marching bands. I watched a very interesting programme about them on the telly the other night. And they, you know, they're not inhuman monster people. In fact, they're a lot more sensible than the EDL, it has to be said. But people are entitled to their views. But you can't impose them on somebody else. This is deliberately provocative. If we had a police commissioner, they might ban it. And that might be the right thing to happen in that case.
Well, just to remind you, the demonstration, EDL demonstration against a proposed mosque in Barton Hill is planned for 23rd of July. Now, a justice climb down is the latest in a string of David Cameron's U-turns, so we're told by the Daily Telegraph. His idol Margaret Thatcher said the lady's not for turning, but since the coming to power, David Cameron has proved that he's not averse to performing U-turns when circumstances demand. And there's been a whole series of these, really, the latest this week, including the Health Secretary Andrew Lansley's proposals to extend competition in health provision was significantly scaled back. We had Caroline Spelman's plans to sell off England's publicly owned forests dropped. And the policy was announced on January the 27th, but gone by February the 17th. So what are your thoughts, Martin, about the latest in a bunch of U-turns?
Well, I think it's part of the problems of coalition government that they're having, isn't it? I mean, when Thatcher was in power, she had a majority of 20-something or whatever, but they were all her people, so she was able to force through anything she wanted. I think it's fair for the Liberals to say that they have watered down some of the stuff that's been coming from the Tory right wing. The problem is that the general direction of the policy is wrong. The cuts themselves are simply the wrong policy. And it's the Liberals can't really get away with saying this, but we've watered them down. But the whole thing is wrong. The whole conception behind them is wrong. And I think the Liberal Party has lost its way. The social wing, liberal wing of the party has basically capitulated to a more kind of free market wing. And I think it's very bizarre that the Liberals should have converted to the free market just as the free market died the death.
The announcement this week is that plans to halve criminal sentences if they plead guilty early have been shelved in the latest of the series of these flagship policy proposals to be scrapped. And these have been a series of flagships, haven't they, Gus? So what does this tell us about the sort of the brain power behind Downing Street?
Well, I'd agree with Martin completely. I mean, basically, all their policies just weren't thought through in the first place. They came up with them.
Forests.
Yep. You can keep on naming them. But basically, I think they were just thought up over too many bottles of wine back in the Eton days. They had no idea. If you actually hear George Osborne speak, he has no concept of economics whatsoever. For these people to be actually running the country, it's a shame for us all, really.
Well, moving on slightly, another story here. What a bunch. Three party leaders and we can't stand any of them, reveals a poll.
Party leaders.
Yes, this is the three main parties. I'm sorry, they don't include you in here. This is a report in the Daily Mail about, I think it was something which was in the Guardian, and it's saying leaders of all three major political parties received bad news today after a poll revealed they're each unpopular with voters. Neither Labour's Ed Miliband, Lib Dem leader Nick Clegg nor Tory David Cameron achieved even a positive rating. Mr Miliband's scores were the lowest at minus 21, followed by Mr Clegg at minus 20 and Mr Cameron at minus 5. So I suppose they've all failed, really, haven't they, if it was a little exam test here. The withering verdict on the Labour leader's first 9 months in the job puts him on a par with the failed Conservative leader Ian Duncan Smith. And I want you to answer this one, Martin, because your leader has got an appalling popularity rating, even though your party is ahead of the Tories. Your leader, it seems, is holding you back.
Well, part of the problem for being the leader of the Labour Party, if you remember what happened with Neil Kinnock, is as soon as whoever it is elected, the Tory press go for the jugular. And they've just been going on about how, you know, they've been making personal attacks on him, basically. I think Ed is actually quite steady in that situation. He's not panicked. He's made a couple of mistakes from my point of view, like trying to stop a drug legalisation debate. I don't agree at all with his idea of not having an elected shadow cabinet. I think Labour voters that I know on the doorsteps are quite pragmatic about this. The leaders have always been rubbish. They always were. The party goes on.
I mean, I wouldn't necessarily agree. If you go back to Harold Wilson, I think he was actually a very good leader. But what I'm saying here is, what are you going to do about this? I mean, when he's saying, it seems like when he's getting criticised, Ed Miliband, his reaction is to say, well, actually, I'm going to control my cabinet. I don't want any of the membership to have anything to do with selecting my cabinet. Don't you think he's really...
Membership, it's the MPs that select the cabinet, not the membership.
He's not actually serving the party by coming up with little projects like that, is he?
What ultimately happened in New Zealand in the 1980s is that the Labour Party split and the trade union money went with the left of the party, which they paradoxically called New Labour. Eventually, if the neoliberal wing of the Labour Party does not put up or shut up, we will split. That's what will happen. I predict it.
And also, you voted for Ed Miliband, didn't you? As a Labour Party member,
I voted for Diane number one and Ed number two.
Well, I suppose, really, in a way, this is great news for the Greens, Gus, isn't it? Because it's leaving the field clear. What we're being told here is Conservative, Lib Dem and Labour...
Can we have Caroline, please, to lead our party?
are all very unpopular. Their leadership is really not working. And for whatever reason, the public don't like these leaders. So why is it, then, do you think this is happening? But I suppose what I'm really asking here is, what has the Green Party got to offer, and what has your leader got to offer?
I think Caroline's got an awful lot to offer.
Caroline Lucas as a Brighton MP, isn't she?
Brighton Pavilion, yes. Basically, as I said at the beginning of the show, all three parties have lost touch with reality, basically, and the average person on the street, and what's actually going on. I think it would be great if the more sort of socially progressive members of the Labour Party and of the Lib Dems, if these two parties do split and could join the Greens and help us make it a really truly alternative party.
What colour would we get out of that?
A very nice shade of green.
I think it'd probably be brown, actually.
The brown shirts. Yeah, we can call it the brown shirts.
And, you know, I'm just bothered. I want to just hear a response from both of you about this whole thing of democracy in our party politics, because surely, you know, we've got, for example, with the cuts, Martin, many people, the grassroots of the Labour Party, are actually against the cuts, and yet your leader, Ed Miliband, goes along to a march of hundreds of thousands of people in London and talks for the cuts.
You've got to distinguish the three positions here. One is no cuts at all. One is the Tory Lib Dem suicide pact with pseudo-monetarism. I was reading a joke by Amartya Sen the other day. Said it's the corset theory of politics. If it's not hurting, it needs to be tighter, dear. There is a genuine debate about the speed of cuts if you're going to have them. But then, of course, there's the whole point about not having cuts at all. And I suspect, you see, if the Greens were in any position of power or authority, your arms were being twisted to go along with this neoliberal agenda. It's happened elsewhere. It happened in Ireland. The Greens were virtually wiped out by being in alliance with Fianna Fáil.
And we certainly wouldn't join a coalition because of that, of those grounds, yeah.
Well, exactly. And I think the real problem is that as a society, we are economically illiterate.
No, I think actually the real problem is that our main political parties are not democratic. They're not representing the membership. I don't know if you'd agree, Gus, because what does your party do to elect your leader?
At the moment, we're one member, one vote. Though this might well change, who knows, in the next 10 years when we do get a sizeable chunk of the population being members. Who knows how, you know, how and where it will go by then, but that will be up to the members to decide.
Okay, on to our next story. UPS air cargo blocked by Britain over security concerns. And this is a story in The Guardian at the end of last week. The Department for Transport has barred the delivery firm UPS from moving air cargo through sites in the UK due to security requirements. A spokeswoman would not reveal which sites had been restricted and why the move had been taken. Asked if it was due to an explosive device, she said the Department of Transport would not give details of security arrangements. Martin, I'll bring you on this one first, because I remember we were talking about this UPS flight last year where there was a massive security alert over a device. It seems that UPS are possibly not doing what they're supposed to be doing as regards to security on their aircraft.
It's very hard to comment on these security stories unless because one doesn't really know the whole picture of what one is commenting on. Let me point out about the this was supposedly from a package from Yemen, wasn't it? I seem to remember. Frankly, we're probably coming off more into the second hour. Most of our listeners by now will be aware that I just do not believe in the war on terror. It's a fantasy. It doesn't exist. Most of what we're seeing is security service mess going on, and then suggesting that that in actual fact there is a terrorist threat. It's largely an invented threat, and what I suspect about this whole business is it's just more booga booga.
Gus?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It's creating the culture of fear, which makes us all very very easy to control, really. It makes us nice little docile animals, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And
as we head for the slaughterhouse.
As we smile as our civil liberties are removed. Okay, and our final story this week. Lulzsec, UK hacker, is no mastermind. British cops working with the FBI detained a 19-year-old after CIA PlayStation hacks. This is a 19-year-old man who's been arrested in Britain after an investigation into hacker attacks on a number of international business and intelligence agencies. The teenager's mother told the BBC Radio Essex her son...
Not a naughty boy, he's just a hacker.
Her son had been arrested at 3:30 a.m. local time Tuesday this week. So, from what you've read of this, Gus, do you think they've got the guy that actually hacked into the PlayStation, or is this, maybe just a bit of guesswork by the police and the FBI?
To be honest, who knows till we actually find out, but all we can guarantee is that this fella's going to go on to a very well-paid job at some point, isn't he?
Yeah, well, that's what they do, isn't it? They get these hackers, and they then get them on the inside to take down other people's stuff. I understand that during the war, the attack on Serbia years ago, they could have taken down their computers, but if they did that, then everybody would learn out how to do it, so they didn't. Cyber warfare, yes, very interesting stuff.
So this is Lulzsec. We've had also the group Anonymous before this. Do you think that there are questions about, and I'm hoping you're going to say yes, Martin, because I do, there are questions about the motives behind these groups, particularly because, certainly with Lulzsec, everybody is part of this group, apparently, is a totally anonymous screen name.
Yeah, well, I think what's going on here is they're trying to create the illusion that there's a big kind of threat out there from cyber hackers, terrorists, whatever. And then, of course, they can control. They want to control the internet. I can't remember what they call it now. The streaming, but you know, that will be sold rather than equal access streaming. And basically,
net neutrality.
That's the word I'm looking for. And basically, what they're trying to do basically is squeeze out the internet version of this show and replace it with a Tesco advert.
Okay, final word from you, Gus.
No, I just pretty much agree with everything that's just been said there. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, maybe you should join the Labour Party, be an old Labour person.
This is one of the tragedies of our politics, is that people like Gus and myself who actually agree are in different parties.
Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next is Sky News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest you just heard there. It's Gus Hoyt. This is from last week. Gus Hoyt, who's a Green Party councillor for Ashley. See you after the news.
Boys, and it is your choice.
CFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is